Good evening. This is Valerie Jackson in Conversation, a program where we talk with some of today's most dynamic artists, innovative thinkers, and interesting personalities. 30 years ago, in a study on education to President Ronald Reagan, it was reported that America's schools were failing. Education spending is up approximately 85% since 1970, yet mainstream education is still hampered with inequalities and disparities. My guest today, however, is a renowned educator who took a different and fun approach to the problem. Ron Clark is the recipient of Disney's Teacher of the Year Award and co-founder of the Ron Clark Academy, a model revolutionary nonprofit middle school in Atlanta. The Academy has received national and international recognition for its unique curriculum of academic rigor, passion, and creativity, coupled with a strict code of discipline. Ron has written 3 books on education, and his latest, Move Your Bus, helps us to identify the types of people on a team, or a bus, if you will, and how to get the most out of each person. Ron, thank you so much for being with me today. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yes, ma'am. I'm thrilled to be on the show. Thank you.
Well, tell me a little bit about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the country, eastern North Carolina, down a dirt road, and all my life I just wanted to travel and see the world, and unfortunately my family didn't have the means to do so. I ended up working at Dunkin' Donuts when I graduated high school and I went to college. I was the first person in my family on either side to go to college. And then when I graduated, I had saved up $600 from Dunkin' Donuts. I told my mama, I said, I'm on travel.
Wow.
I want to go around the world. And she freaked out. She said, you got to get a job. I said, no, I'm going. And all I could afford, I couldn't even afford a round trip ticket. I could afford a one-way ticket. And I got a one-way ticket to London, England. And I said, I'll figure it out and find my way back. And I did.
Did you enjoy school as a child, though?
I did. I loved school. I was quite mischievous. I got in some trouble here and there. I always had too much energy. But as a teacher now, it helps me a lot because I deal with those kids the best because I know exactly what they're thinking before they do it.
Were you a good student?
Yes, yes. I was on the honor roll, and I didn't miss a day of school from third grade through ninth grade.
Ooh.
I loved to learn. I'm very competitive, and so I worked really hard, and I was always in charge of something. I was in charge of the editor of the newspaper, and I was the president of this club and that club. And actually, that's what got me suspended from school one time, because when I was in eighth grade, I was the editor, and I wanted to write stories that I wanted to write that I thought would be meaningful to the teenagers. And I said, I'm going to write these stories about teachers. I said, I'm going to tell about the good teachers and the bad teachers and what they can do better, which is kind of funny because that's kind of what I do now. But and so I got called into the principal's office, and he said, Ron, I love your passion, I love your energy, but you can't do that. And I said, well, it's freedom of speech. He said, you're in junior high school, we got some limitations. And he said, don't do it again. But I did it again, and so he kicked me off the newspaper. So I went and I handwrote out a whole newsletter, went to the Shell station, Xeroxed it for 25 cents a copy at the Xerox at the Shell station, and passed it out around school. I said, it's my freedom of speech. And he called me back in the office. He said, Ron, we got to suspend you for 3 days, buddy. He said, you can't do that.
And what did your parents say?
Oh, they wanted to kill me. So I was mischievous. And so a lot of the kids I've worked with have been quite mischievous.
Right.
And so when they get in trouble, I think I have a patience with them, and I know how to talk to them because I was there.
Did you go to college?
Yeah, I went to East Carolina University.
Okay.
And I went there 4 years. I worked at Dunkin' Donuts 40 hours a week, like
okay.
I said, throughout
mm-hmm.
college.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually got a scholarship. I didn't want to be a teacher, but my family couldn't afford to send me to college. And so my mom said, hey, why don't you take this scholarship? I said, it's just for teachers. She said, look, here's the deal. Just take the scholarship. Then when you graduate, just don't teach. I said, well, isn't that dishonest? She said, look, work with me here. We got to do something. So I took the scholarship.
And, work with me here.
And I wanted to be a broadcaster. I wanted to do this. And then I wanted to be an archaeologist. So I kept changing my major. And the person who was in charge of the program after 2 years called and said, Ron, you ain't taking one single education course. What are you thinking? I said, oh, I'm not going to teach. And they said,
oh,
what?
No.
They said, you have to get a teaching degree. So I got a teaching degree in history, never thought I would use it, but that's how I ended up down that path.
But your father was a Was your father a DJ?
My parents were DJs when I grew up. Uh-huh. And not the kind of DJ at the radio station, but like at the nightclub with the turntables.
Really?
Yeah, when I was a little kid, I can remember my mom not being able to find a babysitter and taking me with them, and I would sleep under the turntables as they played at the nightclub.
So now I know why you use rap in music classes and things like that. Well, tell me a little. Was there something that happened in your past that kind of convinced you or gave you the hint that you could actually be a good teacher or a great teacher even? Was there a turning point, or did you just basically kind of slide into it?
It never really crossed my mind. I wanted to be an archaeologist. I was in Romania. I was working in an excavation site. They were digging up the grave of Vlad Dracul, who's the original Dracula.
Wow.
And I ate a rat. It's a long story. It was cooked, but it wasn't cooked well, and I got really sick. And after 2 weeks, I had lost about 15 pounds, and I wasn't getting better, so I had to fly home to North Carolina. And my mom picked me up and took me straight to the hospital. I was in the hospital for 2 nights. I had partial paralysis of my left lung.
Goodness.
So I was really sick. And a local teacher had just passed away that week at the local school. This is a challenging school. And my mom said, "You got to go teach at that school." And I said, "I can't breathe. I can't do anything." She said, "Well, look, it's just substitute teaching. All you got to do is sit at that desk and watch those kids." And so I went to the school, and the principal was like, "Oh, we need you. This class has learning disabilities, behavior problems. You're just the man for the job." And I said, "No, I ain't." And she said, "What, you don't want this job?" And I said, "No, ma'am." She said, "Then why are you here?" I said, "My mama made me come."
You are so funny.
And so she took me down. She said, "Can I at least introduce you to the students?" And she walked me down to a classroom. A child had been put in a trash can to be disciplined. He was standing in a trash
really
can.
So that was really true. That was in the movie, the Ron Clark story. Mm-hmm. That
really
was
happened.
Really true.
It's a fourth grade teacher. She had taught there 30,000 years. She did whatever she wanted. And nobody even questioned her. So she would stick kids in that trash can. She had good discipline, but she was crazy. And then I looked in the class I was supposed to teach, and they were going crazy. And this little boy said, "Is you going to be our new teacher?" And I said, "Oh, my gosh, I guess so." That was 21 years ago, and I've been doing it ever since.
So you went from roaming with gypsies in Romania, Will. That's basically where you had that bad rat. But you go from that to establishing the Ron Clark Academy. That's a big gap there.
It's crazy.
In the meantime, though, you taught in Harlem. Was this the school? This was not the school. This was when you moved from North Carolina to Harlem, right?
I was in North Carolina for 5 years, and I was the teacher of the year there, and I had been invited to the White House 3 different years to be honored by the president. So I had a lot of success in North Carolina because I was different. And whenever you do something differently, people get attention for it. So after 5 years, I saw a TV show that showed schools in New York City that have violence and overcrowded classrooms, and it broke my heart. And I said, "Mama, I'm going to go pack up and teach one of them schools in Harlem." She said, "They kill people in Harlem." I said, "No, they don't." I said, "It's going to be great." So I packed up my car, went up to Harlem, stayed at the YMCA. It was all I could afford. I walked them down the streets, and I found this one school, and this kid came busting out of the back door, and he was huffing and puffing, and the resource officer was trying to pull him in. So I slid in the door after him. She drug him in down to the office, put him in the chair, and went to call his mama. And that kid was sitting there going, so I didn't know what to do. So I just kind of sat down beside him, and he kept going. And finally, I just leaned over to him, and I said, "You know what? I was breathing like that one time, and I passed out." And he said, "For real?" And I said, "Uh-huh." So I started talking to him, and after a while, he said, "If you were my teacher, I wouldn't get in so much trouble." Because he said, "You talk to me like you care about me."
Oh.
So I took it as a sign, that's my school, and I started teaching in Harlem in that school.
And we got the Ron Clark Academy out of it. What's so different about the Ron Clark Academy? What do you think are the two most unique things about your school that really sets it out from all the others who are trying new things?
I'll say I've been to all 50 states, because when I was in Harlem, I was named as the Teacher of the Year for the country, so I got to go visit all 50 states, over 300 schools, and what I saw was a dumbed-down education system. We've wussified our system, and it's all about coddling children. We're more concerned with this country right now about the self-esteem of children than we are about really educating kids. And I'm a historian. When you look historically at all different civilizations through the past who rose to supremacy, you can look at the Roman Empire, the British Empire. whenever they start to decline and others rise, they have one thing in common. It's not the decline of the military or the economy, it's the education system. Because what happens is that when you rise to power, you tend to make life easier for the youth. The youth don't have to work as hard, they're giving more because they're at the top. And so when they aren't taught a work ethic and they become the adults, they don't work as hard. Right now we are 27th in the nation in terms of in the world in terms of education, and that's because we are coddling and babying the youth. Why does every kid on a little league team these days have to get a trophy? They all ain't that good. We just give them so much. Who should get the trophy is the MVP. And when your child says, why did I not get a trophy? You ain't the MVP. That's why you ain't getting a trophy. So what makes our school different is that we don't coddle kids. We're real with them. We're honest. Frederick Douglass said it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken adults.
Yes.
And so what we do is that we're honest with them. We're realistic. When they're great, we tell them we're great. When they're not, we tell them it's not good enough. We don't give A's. We don't give B's. You have to work at our school to pass. These kids come to our school. They've been on the honor roll before, and they struggle just to pass at our school because we ain't playing. We only had 3 kids at our entire school make all-A honor roll because we're not playing.
Wow.
The more you expect, the more you're going to get.
Now, you actually have educators who come to the Ron Clark Academy to observe your classes, your teachers. How do you teach educators to inspire students?
Sure. Every Friday, we open our doors. And so the goal of our school was to be a model. I used to try to speak for U.S. Department of Education, and I used to go do these big events around the country. And I realized there's too much bureaucracy. I said, I just want to find an old factory somewhere, turn it into the best school in the world, and then bring people from all over the country and the world to see it, to see this is what a school should look like. And so that's what we built in downtown Atlanta. We started in 2007. We have now had just under 30,000 superintendents, principals, and teachers from all over the country and around the world visit Atlanta just to spend time in our school. They come in our classrooms. They learn about our leadership models. They learn how we teach, about how we inspire kids. And I think you said it best, how do we teach them to inspire? It starts with the teacher. Our teachers, we don't have desks in our classroom. We cannot sit down the entire lesson. We don't waste time. It's passion. It's energy. It's movement. When I go across the country, it's just slow and boring, y'all. Your kids, those of you who are listening to this, your kids are bored to death in school because teachers are sitting at desks. They're passing out worksheets. They're teaching to a test. What we do at our school is we teach with passion. It's happy. There's energy. Studies show if you smile, when you give a child information, the child is more likely to remember and believe it. Problem is, most teachers look so unhappy across the country. You have to move. When I go to visit educators' classrooms, teachers tend to look at a board. They should look in the eyes of students. So we teach teachers small things like that. Your arms should be above your waist at least 60% of the time when you're talking and teaching with students. You have to move from the left to the right of the classroom. So we teach teachers small things like that. And also we teach them big things like how to wrap a lesson. Now let's get down to some presidential learning. We'll start with George Washington straight from Mount Vernon. The first president and commander and chief fought the Revolutionary War so we can be free. So we teach them how to wrap, how to dress in costumes, how to get on the desk, how to make it fun and exciting. But I think the most important thing we show them is that we look at our class, and let's say I have 40 kids in a classroom because we have big classes. And if I see my smartest kid, that's who I teach to every day. And the expectation is that every child in that class has to get to that level. We don't teach down, we teach up. And all across the country, we're teaching down and dumbing down the education system.
In the preface to your book, The End of Molasses Classes, you write, quote, I don't have the patience to rebuild the educational system in America by going through politics and up against the bureaucracy of the system. So, Ronna, I have to ask you, if good, creative, demanding educators like you don't have the patience to rebuild the system, to fight the bureaucracy, how does or how will public education survive?
Right. Hopefully they will join us in our grassroots revolution. The Ron Clark Academy was meant to be a spark for individual educators who wanted to be better and who wanted to find a way to fix the system. I knew that I couldn't fix it from the top down. It's just a mess. And so I thought, maybe we can start something grassroots. Maybe if I build this school and say this is the best school, the best model in the world, maybe people will come see it. It will start to change a mindset. And so now to have 30,000 superintendents, principals, and educators who have modeled everything we do in their school systems across the country, we are slowly starting to gain momentum, gain power, and to gain influence in the education community. You have school districts all over the country, Houston, Lincoln, Nebraska, Los Angeles, D.C., where they are modeling everything we do at our school. They've taken our model and they've done it district-wide. And so slowly but surely, it's happening. We are booked up. Educators who want to come, we are booked up through October right now because we cannot meet the demand of people, the hundreds and hundreds of people each week who want to come because they want to be part of this revolution. So I didn't think I had patience to do it from the top, but I said we as individual educators can do the best we can to be inspirational, to be motivational, to teach our kids, to push them. And if we all stand strong, we can force the whole system to change by our power.
Now, the other educators come in the afternoon or during the whole day
observe
and take notes. And
sure. Sometimes they'll stay with us 3 days, sometimes two, or sometimes just mm-hmm. one. Mm-hmm. They come in at 8:15 in the morning. We greet them in the library. Now, in our library, we have a huge two-story bungee jump, and so kids are hooked up, and teachers, they go flying through the library. We tell our kids, if you read a certain number of books, you get to jump a certain number of times, so our kids are excited. We wanted our library to be loud because kids think of a library as boring and quiet. So we said, why don't we make our library colorful, vibrant, exciting, a place where kids could not wait to get to be.
Right.
And so our library is wide open. And then the educators, they go throughout our school from class to class. I was intentional. I hired only the best educators in the country. Most of the teachers who teach at our school are former National Teachers of the Year or teachers who have just won national recognitions. For example, our math teacher, Dr. Camille Jones, she got her doctorate from Columbia. She was just she just won the Presidential Award in Mathematics. She's about to go be honored by President Obama at the White House. So what we did is we had the best teachers in the world. And so as an educator to visit, you go from class to class seeing the best educators handle real situations in their mm-hmm. classrooms. Mm-hmm. We did not cherry pick our kids. A third of our kids come with learning issues. A third of our kids have behavior problems. A third of our kids are average or gifted. And so we have all different types of kids in our school. But what happens is that we focus on the gifted and encourage all the other kids to get to that level.
You're listening to In Conversation, and I'm your host, Valerie Jackson, speaking with America's teacher and co-founder of the Ron Clark Academy, Ron Clark. We'll be back after this short break. This is Valerie Jackson back in conversation this evening with one of today's most innovative leaders in education, Ron Clark of the Ron Clark Academy. I think I recently read somewhere that most of our public school teachers in the U.S. graduate in the bottom half of their class, while high-performing schools in other countries often pull from the top 20% of their teacher graduates.
Yeah. Right now in our country, 90% of our educators come from the bottom third of college graduates. And then I just got back from Finland 2 months ago, and in Finland, they come from the top 20% of college graduates. And I'd always heard that it was because of the pay and how they just pay teachers more. So I went to Finland to see myself and actually found out that the average income for an educator in America is $43,000 a year. The average income in Finland is $44,000 a year. And so I realized it was comparable. It was very similar. And in many places in Finland, the cost of living was higher. And so I tried to find out why would they get the top 20% and we can't. And they said it was just because of the way the public treated educators. They are revered and they're trusted. I remember in the 70s when I was in elementary school and Miss Clark went and told my mom that I had been bad that day. My mom tore me up because whatever Miss Clark said, there was no question it. Today, if I go to a parent and I say, and I have the kid standing there and I'll say, well, John wasn't so good today. He stuck a pencil in someone else. The mama will look at the child and say, is that true? Did that happen? Of course it happened. I just said it happened. But there's a lack of trust of teachers. They're not revered. Parents have control over the education system in America, and they're ruining it because as soon as a teacher gives a C, the parent wants to know what's wrong with this teacher's teaching methods. This teacher did this. This teacher was rude to my child. And everyone's so concerned that their child's feelings are going to get hurt. And so it's a problem. So I think if we want to get better educators, we have to not necessarily pay them more, but treat them better.
What do you think the average failing school and the teacher who works there needs the most?
I think what the average failing school needs the most is not technology. I don't think it's a better building. I don't even think it's textbooks. I think you need better teachers and teachers who actually see what excellence is. When I travel all over, so every year, and I go in these schools, and it's slow and it's boring. And the problem is, I don't think the educators have ever seen anything different. I think they teach in the way they were taught. And so what we do at our school, the Ron Clark Academy, is that we show this is what it's supposed to look like. This is what great teaching is. This is how you question kids. This is how you don't waste time. This is how you organize your lessons. So when teachers come to our school, they will cry. I'll be teaching and teachers will watch and they will be sobbing so loud that I have to ask them to be quiet because my kids can't focus because they'll say, I didn't know what it was supposed to look like. I've never been a good teacher. I want to be better. And so I think part of the problem is that the teachers don't even realize what they don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously your model for education is highly successful, you know, the Ron Clark Academy approach. But you receive a lot of funding from the private sector that public schools don't get. Delta Airlines sponsors all of your flights out of the country with your kids, other in-kind contributions. How does your model get transferred to government-funded schools that have low budgets and find it very difficult to retain teachers or even to help students pass standardized tests?
Yeah. The Ron Clark Academy is kind of like Walmart. If you go to Walmart, you don't put everything in your cart at Walmart because you don't want everything in the store. When educators come to visit the Ron Clark Academy, they're not going to do everything they see in our school and try to do every program. They might say, well, I can't. Delta's not going to fly me to South Africa, but I can question kids better in this math class, or I like this discipline program, or I like the way you structure this reward system. We have so much going on at our school, and we tell educators, don't feel like you have to do everything that you see. This is your professional development. Take what works for you. And so we when educators hear that, they feel like, oh, okay, I can just take what I need, what works best. And so it's allowing them to improve on what they need help with the most.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about No Child Left Behind?
I don't have a whole lot of positive to say, unfortunately. I think we overtest in America, and I think No Child Left Behind put too much focus on testing. For example, at our school, we do tests because we have to, but we have a rule that we won't mention it all year long. We tell kids you're learning for the joy of learning. We never say things like, we need to learn this because it might be on that test, or if you don't pass this test, I'm going to lose my job. So the last week of school, we tell our kids, oh, this week we're going to have a celebration of all you've learned. We're going to, you know, show them, we're going to take this test to show all you've learned this year. We make it feel like it's a party, and our kids' test scores are through the roof. The test scores are high at our school, not just because we don't put pressure. We teach our butts off. Mm-hmm. But I think the problem is No Child Left Behind to put too much of a focus on
They require 17 tests in math
and too much.
Science and so forth.
And also what it did was it, No Child Left Behind, it created this concept of if you've got a class of 30 and you got a kid in there that's really struggling, don't leave that child behind. You got to help that child. So we really dumbed down the education system because it made it slower. Let's make sure this kid gets it too. And our gifted kids were bored.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
we're not really challenging our gifted kids in America to this day. And so what happens, look, y'all, that's our brain trust. How are we not going to challenge our gifted kids? In China, they have more gifted children than we have children in our whole country. China is putting billions of dollars a year into gifted programs. We're not. Mm. America's not focused on gifted education programs. It's just not happening.
You mentioned Common Core. What are your feelings on that?
You know, actually, I thought there were more positives than negatives to it because I really liked the rigor. I enjoyed the rigor, and I know a lot of people didn't, and a lot of people didn't want to say that states had to be mandated to do the same things, but I actually liked it. So at our school, what we did was we took what we liked from it, And then we pulled from the Georgia Performance Standards, and we pulled from a couple of other places. We kind of created our own that we thought really worked for us. I think that's what opponents of Common Core are saying, give more freedom to states and to people to adjust instead of just saying you have to do it this way. But if you think about it, there's all these things on Facebook where these people say, oh, look at this Common Core math. Look how dumb it is. Look how dumb. But if it's taught in the right way, it really does make sense. It's just people who aren't mathematicians don't understand the way it's written or why it was written in that way.
Hmm. You mentioned earlier about the educators that you help to inspire students. There are a lot of things that really go into a student's success, as you know. One of the main factors, I think, is time. How many hours a day is that child working, studying, so forth? How is that time spent? In successful schools, a lot of time is spent on oral language development. What do you spend a lot of time on at the Ron Clark Academy?
We probably spend more time on oral language development than any school in the country. And this is a little, you know, we're a little different, so this may offend some people, but when students come into our school, the majority of the kids I teach are African-American, majority are low income. We have put a focus on proper presentation. I said, because when you go into this world, if you can't present and talk in a certain way, people aren't going to listen to you. I said, so we have to have two types of ways to speak. I said, we're going to speak around our friends, then we're going to have a professional speak. So we teach professional speak, and it's in all classrooms at all times. And so when kids come in fifth grade, it's really difficult because if they say something that doesn't come across as articulate, or if they're mumbling, or if they say, me and my mom, nope, you're done. And we cut them off instantly. And the kids learn, in order to express yourself, you have to do it in a certain way. And so fifth grade's a little rough for our kids, but by sixth grade, if any of you have met any of our kids from the academy, they're articulate and well-spoken and poised and confident, but it comes because in fifth grade it's a rough year. By sixth grade, most of them have it. But in terms of the time we spend on it, there's every day when our kids answer questions, they have to stand up to deliver their answer. They stand up to ask their question. They have to do presentations constantly. Our kids are called up to the front to teach, to instruct, to be leaders, to give tours. And in terms of the time we spend on it, it's a lot. All across the country, there's this push when you look at Oregon and Washington State, and when you look at a lot of places in the West, they want to extend the school day because they say, we want to extend the hours of the day in order to get more things in, like oral instruction, and in order to be competitive globally. I really don't think we should extend the school day because the kids are already exhausted as it is by the time they get home. But I do think we need to improve the quality of the day we have. We're wasting time. It's just slow, and kids are changing classes and take 15 minutes to work on your homework. And it's just slow, and there's no energy in the class. So I think we need to improve the quality of the day and expect kids to speak more, to present more. And then that would solve the problem.
And you use it, or at least I do with the Maynard Jackson Youth Foundation. We use that oral language development in everything, whether we're talking about music or if we're talking about a science a venue that we're going to go visit. Somehow or another, like you said, we work it in the language. How is this to be said? How do you approach a subject? The first 12 seconds are so important in terms of communication with someone. Mm-hmm. Things like that. So it is an ongoing process. It just doesn't happen in English class.
We spend 3 days. We do an orientation in the summer on eye contact, firmness of a handshake, first introduction, proper etiquette, how to tie a tie. So we teach our kids everything you need for presentation because, unfortunately, in America, a lot of what will make you successful is how you present yourself.
And also, I think the part of one of the key things that you stress, too, is that kids don't come here knowing how to do homework or knowing how to be polite or knowing how to critically think. They have to be taught this. We just can't assume that they pick it up through osmosis.
My grandmama raised me, and she had a whole list of rules. And all of her rules were about how to uplift people, how to have proper etiquette, manners, respect. When I started teaching, I said, well, nobody's teaching these kids these common sense things. So I made a list, and I called them my essential 55. And then Oprah Winfrey, when she read the list, she said, you got to put this in a book. And y'all know when Oprah tells you to write a book, you write the book. So I wrote this book called The Essential 55. Miss Winfrey profiled it on her show, and it was number two in the nation behind Harry Potter for a whole summer. Mm-hmm. And the money from that book all went into a foundation, and that's how we were able to open the Ron Clark Academy in downtown Atlanta.
Now, we've talked about the time that the teachers give, the time that you give, the time that the students give. How many hours a year should a family be devoted to volunteering in a school?
Well, when I started off in North Carolina, I told my parents I wanted them to volunteer 40 hours that year in my classroom. And most of them did it. When I got to Harlem and I went door to door visiting my families there, I had a mom say, what if I don't do it? I said, well, nothing. I said, I'd be disappointed. I'm letting you know this is my expectation. And all of those families in Harlem met their 40 hours.
Wow.
Even the lady who was like, what if I don't do it? Because there's something about once you set an expectation for someone that they want to meet the expectation. Also, they saw I was busting my butt. And they said, my God, this man's killing himself to teach our kids and all he's doing. Let's support him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had parents calling me, Ms. Clark, what do you need? Cupcakes at midnight. You call me. I'm going to hook you up. I got you. What do you need? Because they saw I was working so hard. So I expect 40 hours in the school or in the classroom a year. And then I expect them at home to help in certain ways. I don't want a helicopter parent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want you to be a hover mother. Don't sit there over the child and do the homework for them. But I want you to make sure they have a place that's quiet, a place that can focus, a place to learn the supplies they need. And then sometimes I might have to say to you, I need you to actually do this assignment with the child. If it's a project, I actually tell my parents, this is the percent you can contribute to the projects. Because let's be real, these parents going to help their child with the project, if it's a home project, more often than not. So I say, you may do 15% this time. You may do 10%. Or sometimes I'll say, you know what, it can be both, 50-50. But here are my expectations. And then so the parents know.
Another factor aside from time is money, the factor of money and access to it. Educational spending really is up about 85% since 1970, yet education hasn't improved. Maybe it's even worse. Are we a country that's disinclined to invest in our kids?
No. So I'm not upset with the amount of money that our country spends in our education system. I am not happy with how the money is allocated. That's a battle that I chose not to fight. But I think one of the biggest mistakes we make is that we don't fire bad teachers, and it's too hard to fire a teacher. And if it's a bad teacher, we try to reduce class sizes. And look, if she's a bad teacher with 30 kids, she's going to be a bad teacher with 13 kids. Reducing the class size really doesn't matter. So I'm in favor, and most good teachers, I think, are in favor of having a class size of 30 and pay me more. Pay teachers more, larger class sizes, and you're going to have a better education system than keeping poor teachers in the system and then just reducing their class size. Also, a problem we have is that we pay everyone the same. If you've taught 20 years and you're a bad teacher, you get paid the same amount as 20 years and you're a great teacher. That doesn't work in business. That doesn't work in the world because teachers realize no matter how much I do, I'm going to get paid the same, and it's just not fair.
Where's the incentive?
No incentive.
Right. Some, though, think that it's really all about race and class and, you know, a disparity in income. What about public schools versus private schools? Do school vouchers help?
You know, people ask me all the time, what's better, private school, public school, charter school? It doesn't matter. What matters are the adults in the building. If you have great adults, great teachers, great leadership, it's going to be a great school. And one thing I love about teaching in Harlem and here in Atlanta is that I teach predominantly African-American kids. About 95% of our school is African-American, and our kids flat rock it. We win every national competition. We just won the National Math Counts competition. We win Model UN. We win everything these kids enter. In Harlem, my kids won the City Science Fair, and so it just shows ethnicity has nothing to do with it. Income has nothing to do with it. You just need a good environment to learn in and a great teacher. When you have those things, these teachers will soar. It has nothing to do with ethnicity. Unfortunately, due to racial barriers, we tend to have kids who live in wealthier areas and have better access to great teachers. In terms of vouchers, personally, our school, it would help. We are a private school, but the majority of our kids just pay $45 a month to come to our school. because their family income's low, so we have to raise money through our teacher training program to pay for them to be able to come to our school. So for our school, it would help, but for 99% of the population, it's not a good idea, because the only people that's really helping generally is wealthier families who would use the voucher for a private school they were already attending.
Mm. What would you do if you were the head of a large district or county school board that needed fundamental shifts to create across-the-board success? Is there any one or two things that you think, would be important?
First of all, I would probably figure out a way to cut the administrative budgets at the central office, because it's too central office heavy. I would have a huge meeting with every individual in the school system, and I would explain what my vision is. I think you have a lot of teachers out there who don't really know what the vision is, and I would set the vision. I'd set a vision for kids, and I would explain the type of educator I'm looking for and what I wanted to see in the classrooms, and I would say I'm going to be out in the schools. And when I come to these schools, this is what I want to see. This is our expectation. And I would just try to build momentum around a goal and a vision of what I really expected to be in the classrooms.
We'll be back after this short break and continue our conversation with Ron Clark, whose academy is responsible for training and transforming over 30,000 educators and administrators throughout the country and the world. Welcome back. I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Joining me in the studio this evening in conversation is Ron Clark. He is a New York Times bestselling author and co-founder of the nationally recognized nonprofit middle school, the Ron Clark Academy. You mentioned a little earlier that every child does not deserve a cookie. This really comes out of your book, The End of Molasses Classes. You offer about 101 extraordinary solutions for parents and teachers for getting our kids unstuck. Give me just a few quick other suggestions that you have. Not every child deserves a cookie. Stop telling them they're entitled.
Yeah, it's also about how you talk to kids. I think the number one most important thing is that we tell kids in America, you're smart, you're gifted. And what happens is that kids will have an inflated sense of self. They'll think, oh, I'm gifted, I'm special, I'm princess. And they end up thinking, oh, so I don't have to work hard or do anything. I already am this. What you should do instead as a parent, as a teacher, is to praise kids for their actions. The way that you just handled that situation showed a lot of intelligence. The way that you just picked up that paper, that was really respectful. I really like the way you cleaned your room. You want to praise actions, because when you praise an action, the child learns, oh, I need to do things for praise, and so they learn to have a work ethic. This country was built by people who had a work ethic, and now these kids these days, they just don't. They're just lazy, and we're just telling them they're special and gifted, and we're not really focusing on what they should do to be gifted. In the book, I talk about not every child deserves a cookie, because I baked cookies one time for my students. I only gave cookies to the kids who had made the good grades and who were working hard, and the parents flipped out. I had a mom who was so angry that her child didn't get a cookie. She said, if you're not going to bake enough cookies so that every child can get a cookie, you should not be baking cookies. I said, what? I said, I was trying to reward kids. I baked plenty of cookies. I said, in fact, I think I ate your daughter's cookie. And that was the worst statement I could ever make, because I was 25 years old. And that woman came to the principal's office, and she was screaming at me, and she said that I would not talk to her daughter like that. I would not publicly humiliate her daughter. It was horrible. I got in a lot of trouble because I hadn't given that girl a cookie. And that is what we have in America, parents who are expecting their children to get cookies. Here's something that is it's a common trend now. You have two kids in your family. It's one child's birthday party, so you buy another little present for the other child so they don't feel like they're left out.
Oh?
Have you done that?
Never.
Thank you. And so it's a crisis. And so that's just one example of how as parents we're coddling children. And if you don't fix it, they're going to be 29 years old living home with you wondering, why doesn't the world love me? When a child is given too much, they begin to feel entitled, like they deserve a lot.
One of the other solutions or suggestions you offered was that children are literal thinkers. You've got to spell it out for them.
Yes.
We just can't assume they know what we mean.
When I first started teaching, I used to tell kids to be respectful, study, study. And kids really didn't know what that meant. And so I started being extremely specific. I showed them exactly how to study. I sat down and I had my students get in a circle around me, and I sat on the floor and I acted like I was a child and I had homework. I said, here's what I would organize it. Now I'm going to go through this. I'm going to do one at a time, and I'm going to do this. Here's how I'm going to study for this section. It took me like 45 minutes. I sat right there and made them watch me, and I talked through as I did the homework. And when I was finished, every kid was like, oh, to this day I have these 20-some-year-old kids come back to me and they'll say, remember that day? For the rest of my life, I did exactly what you showed. And so sometimes kids just need to be shown exactly how to do something and not just be told to do it.
The one of the things I've learned in researching this topic is that our universities seem to be striving. Why can't our K through 12 grades, kindergarten to 12th grade, why can't we thrive like the universities appear to be doing?
I think one thing that you see a big difference is that our universities really challenge kids. It's hard. Universities, if you're going to be there and if you're going to stay there, you're going to have to work. There's a higher expectation, and so our college students tend to increase their effort. When you look at the Hope Scholarship in Georgia, I think in a lot of ways it's a big crock because so many, over 3/4 of the kids who get the Hope Scholarship lose it because they're not prepared when they get to college. And it breaks my heart that we have this money here for these kids, and they get to college and they're not prepared. Our high school system and our middle school systems, they're just not preparing kids for college. And so they get there, and then it's dumbed down, and then they drop out. But the students who remain in college are the ones who are working hard, who are driven, and so therefore it's making our universities look like they're more successful.
Do you see any trends in public education that you think are working?
The infusion of technology is helping greatly because we have these things called Promethean boards. Have you ever seen a Promethean board? It's like a whiteboard in a classroom, but it's interactive. And so the students, they can have tablets or these active expressions. They hold these little devices where if I ask a question, they can all enter their answer. The results appear on the board, the screen. I can put a problem on the board, press a button, and it zooms out to all of the individual devices the students are holding. So Promethean is doing a lot of great things in terms of technology technological advances. You can pull up videos. Like one time I was doing a lesson on an oil derrick, and the kids were like, "What's an oil derrick?" I said, "You know, the oil derrick, the thing that the oil shoots out of. It's black and it looks like the Eiffel Tower." And they said, "What? Well, I've never seen one." So I just typed in "oil derrick" and bloop, a 15 second.
You're saying oil derrick.
Oil. I'm sorry. I am so country. I'm sorry. Oil. Oil derrick. It's the thing that looks like the Eiffel Tower that the oil shoots out of. And so I guess every listener was like my students, because maybe the kids knew, they just didn't understand my language, my accent. So I just typed it in, and 15-second video popped up. And so the advent of technology in the classroom is a great help, because if you're a great teacher, it's going to make you a phenomenal teacher. If you're a bad teacher, it makes it so that the class isn't so miserable because there's something in that classroom that's exciting.
I'm talking to Ron Clark, but before we wrap up, I have got to talk about your book, Move Your Bus.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. It gave me some insights into a couple of groups that I'm working with. You talk about recognizing different types of workers in an organization, whether it's a school or a business. Tell me a little bit about your bus story.
Sure. So it's for anybody, for any business, any corporation, any school. It's how we run the Ron Clark Academy. People come every week, hundreds, just to watch how we run our school. And so I decided to take those principles and put it into a book. And it's called Move Your Bus because we picture our school like it's a bus. Now, the bus has no gas, and so we have to move our bus, which means we want to achieve our goals, go as far as we can. So we've cut holes in the floor of the bus. We've all put our feet down, and we're going to Fred Flintstone it. We're going to try and move the bus as fast as we can. In every organization, you tend to have some runners. Now, the runners are flat killing it. They're your best workers. They come early. They stay late. They're positive. They're your real go-getters. Then you got some joggers, and they're keeping up the best they can. They do their job, but they're not really a runner. The one thing about joggers, though, they think they're runners. They will tell you all day long. I'll do book signings, and people will come up and say, "Hey, you know that story you told about that bus? I'm one of them runners." And I'll think to myself, jogger, because runners don't go around telling everybody I'm a runner.
Exactly.
They just do it. Joggers want a little bit more attention. Then you've got some walkers, and the walkers are going so slowly the bus is kind of pulling them, and they want everyone to slow down. And they're going to complain about the runners, and y'all are doing the most, and why are you always doing so much? They're complaining because if everyone would slow down, they could walk at a more comfortable speed. They don't want it to be highlighted what they're not doing. And then finally, we have some individuals who have picked up their feet, they've crossed their legs, and they're dead weight. They're the riders, and they're riding on the bus. They make the rest of us have to run and move harder, and they're just complaining and negative and sucking the life out. So what I used to do as a leader, I used to look at my bus, like most of us do as leaders, and I focused on those riders because they were just sitting. I said, I got to get them to be better. If I could fix them, we would have such a better business. And I learned that when I put all my effort into a rider, I could finally get a rider to drop his feet and walk. But I learned a rider ain't never going to run. A rider ain't never going to jog. And I decided that I didn't want to spend my life getting riders to walk. I felt like it was a waste of my time and I didn't enjoy it. So I decided to put all my energy instead on the runners, which is normally we think they're fine, so we leave them alone. But I started inspiring them, encouraging them, giving them extra resources. If I got money for a conference, I sent them to it. I said, let me help you. And so I put all my energy in giving them autonomy, freedom. If they had an idea, I said, let's go for it. And what happened is when those runners felt validated and they felt like they weren't being treated like a rider, they were being treated special, they started killing it. They were running at supersonic speed, and the whole energy of the bus changed. And what happens is that those riders, the disparity between how slowly they were going and how quickly the runners were going got so greater that a lot of them realized that it wasn't a place for them and they left. But then some of them said, I've got to improve. I've got to go faster because it's too obvious that I'm not doing the job I need to be doing here.
Talk about the drivers.
Sure. The driver is the person who's in charge of the organization, and you have to determine the route you're going to take, how we're going to handle these potholes up ahead, and how we're going to tinker with the bus. And one of the hardest parts of being a driver is that when someone on the bus isn't doing their job or if they do something the wrong way, you have to kind of point it out. And I love when I go to a runner and I'll say, hey, you know what? The way you handle that situation, I think next time you might want to do this instead. My runners will accept the criticism and say, no problem, got it, don't worry about it. My walkers and riders will say, well, in my defense, no one's ever told me to do it that way. All right, this has never happened before. And this is not my fault because they want to complain. And so in the book, I talk a lot about how whether you're, no matter what you're doing on the bus, how to handle criticism and how to handle it from the driver is one of the best things that you can learn as an employee if you really want to impress the person who's in charge.
You have a brief description of how to map a route, and I'm just going to quickly read them because we're running short on time. First of all, you have to allow runners to shine, help joggers be their best selves, giving them a little affirmation, show walkers how to improve. You have to be very clear about demonstrating your values with walkers. Equip people to meet your expectations. What? Talk about that a minute.
Sure. Whenever something doesn't go right in our at our school, or because we're a business, we're training thousands of teachers all over. I mean, it's a business, and whenever something doesn't go right, my first step is to look at myself, and I ask myself, was I specific? Was I clear about my expectations? And if I was, then I hold the person accountable and I let them know, okay, I'm not happy, this didn't work out. How can we make sure this doesn't happen again? But if I realize maybe I wasn't specific enough, I put the blame on myself and I say, allow me to apologize. I don't believe I was specific enough with my expectations here. I want to be real specific now so that next time we make sure this doesn't happen. And so that's what I mean there. And you've got to be so specific with walkers, and you've really got to spell it out for them because they tend to not know how to jog. And joggers don't really know how to run. But the one thing that joggers need more than anything is they need a little bit more validation. They really need you to know, they want to know that you see them. And then when they see that you are noticing they're doing better, then they'll go faster.
One of the things I believe in the book that struck me too was you said 9 words that you learned that were very important.
I'm so sorry, it'll never happen again. Mm-hmm. When I got in trouble, actually it goes back to the cookie story. When the parent came in and was screaming, my child should have got a cookie. Well, my principal defended me and said, you know what, Mr. Clark baked those cookies and he didn't have to give one to every child. I'm going to support him here. The parent was so furious, she walked out and slammed the door. And I was like, yes, the principal supported me. And then the principal looked at me and she fussed me out. She said, Ms. Clark, what are you thinking? How are you going to tell that woman you ate her daughter's cookie? What are you thinking? You can't do that. That's like putting gasoline on a fire. I'm so angry with you. This is not how I want to spend my morning. And she was fussing me out. And I wanted to defend myself, but I had tears in my eyes and I was 25. And so I just said, I'm so sorry. It'll never happen again. And she said, all right, Mr. Clark, go back to your class and your cookies. I said, huh? She said, that's all. Go back to your class and your cookies. And I walked out and I was like, she crazy. I was like, what's wrong with that woman? But I realized I had said the golden words. Whenever you get in trouble, your administrator or the person who's supervising you just wants to hear, oh, I'm sorry, it won't happen again. That's the main thing they want to hear. Then the bus can keep moving. If it has to turn this long, drawn-out conversation and you're defending yourself, the bus has to stop, and no one wants that.
One of the traits you listed in your book, essentially 11 traits for excellence. You mentioned appreciation as one of those traits for
yes.
excellence. Why appreciation?
In my book, The Excellent 11, I think appreciation is the main thing my grandmother taught me in life, and I think it's the main way we've built our school, the academy. When I first came to Atlanta, nobody would really give me anything. I said, I'm going to take this old factory and buy it, and it's in a challenging area, and no company, business, individual would give funds. Delta, they were the first ones that came on and said, we're going to get behind it, then Coca-Cola, then Comcast, and then Verizon. But it took a while. But the way we did it was that we built the relationship. Delta just gave a little bit to start with. Coke gave a little bit. I think the first thing was $3,000. But we sent thank you cards, updates, letters. I visited Coca-Cola just to say, I don't need anything right now. I just want to give you an update on that $3,000 you gave and let you know how we're doing. So it was lots of meetings just to give updates. And everyone ended up saying, my gosh, that guy down there, that Ron Clark and his team, they show appreciation better than anyone. And so the next year was a $12,000 gift and then $25,000. This year we got $250,000 from Coca-Cola.
Wow.
And it happened just because we've built a relationship. We show appreciation. We let them know where the money goes. We're very clear about that. And we don't always go to them to ask for things. We go to them to ask them to partner with us, to volunteer, and just to let them know how our kids are doing. And they say they feel like they know the kids. They know our school so well. Appreciation builds a connection.
This has really been a joy to talk
with you, Ron. I love you.
You
are so sharp and beautiful and lovely, and I've always wanted to meet you, so I was thrilled to be here.
Thank you so very much. I thoroughly enjoyed this. I've been talking with Ron Clark of the Ron Clark Academy, and we've been talking about education and moving your bus and a whole lot of good stuff. Until next time, this is Valerie Jackson in Conversation. Thanks for joining us this evening. You can listen to this and other episodes of In Conversation by visiting our audio archive online at wabe.org/inconversation. This series is a production of WABE FM 90.1 and Public Broadcasting Atlanta. The producer for this program is Marjorie Greenbaum. The technical producer and editor is Mike Johns. Programming support by Lois Reitzis and Dave Barrowswain. Until next time, this is Valerie Jackson in Conversation. Good night.